Well, I don't stand here as the figure of authority, largely because most of you know me anyway, so any attempt at authority is doomed to failure. Also, poetry is not an area that I think begs for authority. A priest is a figure of authority, a judge. Occasionally a politician, very occasionally. Obviously our parents are figures of authority, necessarily so, but I don't think a poet is. I think a poet is more akin to a friend, and a friend is someone I chose to be alongside for a given period of time, and occasionally, of course, one outgrows that friend. The poems that I'm going to present tonight will be presented as friends. I'm not going to look at them as a surgeon, although if you ask me questions about technical aspects, I'm happy to start answering, but I'm not going to venture into, you know, a masterly analysis, because that's a different venue. What I do want to do is begin with an image. Imagine an 11-year-old boy delivering newspapers. They're not real newspapers. They're actually community newspapers. Now, what's the distinction between real and community? Well, actually, politicians make it all the time. Financiers make it all the time. But in this instance, all I'm saying is it's the community newspaper that reports on how the Scout Group fundraising went, how the local school hall fundraising is going, pretty much fundraising, where the bake-off is going to happen, and it's generally accompanied by a lot of advertising. And I was that 11-year-old boy, and I was circling the eastern suburbs of Christchurch, even at the time, in the early 1970s, amongst the poorest suburbs anywhere in New Zealand. I lived in my parents' home. It was one block away from 499 state houses, at that time the largest state housing area anywhere in New Zealand, including Auckland. The primary school I went to basically consisted of young people trying to pretend they had a uniform, being sent out by parents under-equipped in terms of lunch, occasionally raiding rubbish bins in school and being told off by teachers rather than helped by them. Essentially, it was a confrontational childhood. It was a confrontational childhood mediated by a very loving father, a Cockney father who broke into song at every second opportunity, often with a grimace of my mother in the side of the room. And I learned from him rhythm, how it can energise you, how it can get into your step, how it works in your groin before I knew what groin meant, how, in fact, you can feel happier just by having a lilt and a line. Later on, when I was approaching the teenage years, the troubled teenage years, I started a project. Every Thursday after he came home from the factory, my father would take my sister and I to the Canterbury Public Library, and I started the project at around 12 years old of reading through the poetry section. Now, this looks like prescience. In fact, I believe it was a very arbitrary act. Children are quite fickle, and they're desperately looking for attention, and they're looking to be taken out of themselves. If you live in a fairly underprivileged environment, you want a rich imagination, and poetry seemed to me a fast-track way to an imaginative life, and it still does, by the way, 40 years later. What do I mean by that? I mean that in the novel, the primacy of attention necessarily goes on creating characterization, and the reader is generally hooked through the novel by attaching their fortunes as a reader to one character or another, certainly in sympathy, even if they don't identify wholly as an individual. In poetry, the language is so precise, so pared back, so resonant, there are so many echoes underneath and alongside each word, that narrative drive, while important, cannot be the main thing. What a poem is doing is something impossible. A poem is trying to inhabit all ages simultaneously in the reader. Now let's unpack that statement. I'm still 4 years old. I have memories. I'm still 16 years old. I'm still confused about girls. I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. I'm still worried about money. I'm annoyed that my friend Ivan's got a better record collection than me. I don't like the colour that the kitchen's painted. I'm 24. I got my first job. I just got my first promotion. I'm really excited. I've already blown the first month's increase in salary. All these people are still inside me. I can access them, some with a great deal of difficulty, some relatively easily, some embarrassingly easily. Adolescent boys come out really easily. You also have these people. What I'm trying to do when I write a poem, and what I suggest that a fine poem does for a reader, amongst many other things, is let you inhabit multiple selves as you read it. You can be the innocent. You can be the cynic. You can be the lover. You can be the lost. You can be the mentor. You can be the nurse. Most people are looking, when they write, to establish a voice that distinguishes what they do from their fellow colleagues. Most people, when they read, are also looking for a voice, but they're not looking for the writer's voice except as it reflects their own. This is not as narcissistic as it sounds. This is actually one of the paths for expanding your understanding. It's about empathy. Vincent Gillespie, the J.R.R. Tolkien Professor of English Literature and Language at Oxford University, opens his essay, The Senses in Medieval Literature, by quoting Scott's poet, Tom Paterson. Poetry is a dark art, a form of magic, because it tries to change the way we perceive the world. That is to say that it aims to make the texture of our perception malleable. It does so by surreptitious and devious means, by seeding and planting things in the memory and imagination of the reader with such force and insidious originality that they cannot be deprogrammed. So a poem goes beyond its occasion because to be worth reading, a poem has to. Now, orators may have a license to lie, as Cicero and Atticus say in his essay Brutus, but poets don't. And here I agree rather unfashionably with the late W.H. Auden. A good poet is good because he speaks what he sees and uses his ability to speak to see even more. Reading poetry is an act of expanding your understanding of self and self's relation to the world. Necessarily so because language is the history of being human. Let's look at that statement. It's a literal statement. It's not even a leap of faith. In 1598, this word was recorded. In 1652, it was recorded again. The meaning had shifted slightly. By the 19th century, the original meaning had actually turned on its head and there was now a pejorative connotation to the word that it hadn't had when it was first coined. In other words, you can look at how human beings have developed in society by looking at the history of every given word. When you're writing a poem, part of your task as a writer is to be acutely aware of the ancestry, the tradition associated with each word, specifically in your locale, because of course here it's critical to think about geography. The way words are used in New Zealand is substantively different to the way they're used in England and America, and indeed in parts of those countries. There are relatively minor shifts within New Zealand. I mean, there is a perceptible shift in the pronunciation of words from Bluff up to Auckland, but it's really minor in international scale, and it doesn't affect the composition or hearing of the word. Even if a writer restricts his conception of the reader to those who speak the same language, I still believe it's impossible to reach, let alone to satisfy, an undifferentiated mass. To say, I write for the people, is meaningless, whereas I write for the person means a great deal. And like many other poets, I attempt to make sense of the senseless, to move with purpose, through the arbitrary, and to learn. And because language is social, then I necessarily have a social vision. It's not coherent, but it is motivating. And of course I do publish books, so I must have a conception of a committed readership, one that is warmed, if not exactly fired up, by my words. So let's fire you up with my first selection of the evening. It's by William Drummond of Hawthorndorf. He lived from 1585 to 1649, and was a friend of Ben Jonson, a great colleague of Shakespeare. The only thing I'd remind you of here, and I feel like I'm teaching you to suck eggs, is the reference to Nimrod. Nimrod, of course, was the biblical founder of Babylon, and he was a mighty hunter. This world the hunting is. This world the hunting is. The prey, poor man, the Nimrod fierce is death. His speedy greyhounds are lust, sickness, envy, care, strife that ne'er falls amiss, with all those ills which haunt us while we breathe. Now if by chance we fly, of these the eager chase, old age with stealing pace casts up his nets, and there we panting die. Cheerfully, Lovestone. I have loved that since I first encountered it courtesy of the late John Summers, who was a bookseller in Christchurch. He had a habit of ambushing his clients, and a bit like your advisor in the exclusive op shop, oh, you can't possibly wear that, oh, you must have that. John said, you need this. Shove a book in your hand. And then he proceeded to read the poem, this far as it happened to you. And I fell in love with it. And love is something that doesn't come that easily. And what attracted me to it, well, principally the diagnosis. But you'll note, even in my poor reading, that the lines tumble but inexorably over one another, there is a very simple thought, which is of course about the fleeting nature of life and how death is going to take everything we value from us. There is in fact no indication of a life to come in the poem, although the biblical reference might suggest that there's a wider frame that the poet isn't teasing out. Essentially, it's a very visceral poem. It works on muscle. It works on sinew. The rhymes are understated. Are and care, amiss, us. So they're deliberately slightly off, which I like because it suggests some discord in the world. I like the fact that the poet has taken the rhyme scheme seriously enough to actually build in an effect that speaks to his meaning. That this is not just a received rhyme. A full masculine end rhyme is comparatively easy to do in English, not nearly as easy, of course, as Italian, but still relatively easy. I now want to make a comment that builds on my initial statement that a poem goes beyond its occasion, because to be worth reading it has to. I think that even a commissioned poem, where one is offered money, this has happened a couple of times in my life, don't take it as the given, in a way is a dishonest enterprise if one simply looks at the commission brief. What one does in writing a poem is go beyond the known. You don't write down only what you know, and you don't write down what's expected of you. You, in fact, open up an area of inquiry when you're writing a poem. And all of the poems I'm reading tonight open up an area of inquiry for me as a writer, and hopefully for you as a fellow reader. A commission, however rare, doesn't let a writer ignore the demands of conscience. Rather, it contextualizes them. Really, if we were to come up with a formula for poetry, I'd say empathy plus metaphor equals an act of compassion. I'll say that again. Empathy plus metaphor equals an act of compassion. Metaphor is when one brings something that isn't associated with something else in conjunction so that they shed light and become one technical thing. It is, in fact, an act of empathy. It's a very technical act of empathy. What is empathy an aid of? Largely compassion, because, in fact, we use empathy day to day to get into the mind of the actor, the actress, the teacher before us, the speaker in front of us, this person, our child who isn't making his or herself clear, other countries when we try and understand why their foreign policy is the way it is, why they've just taken the action they have. It is absolutely essential for ethical conduct to have empathy. But the end result of empathy, it seems to me, through poetry, is always compassion, otherwise the poems fail. Unfortunately, it's not always compassion in the wider political world. As we see, often it's vengeance and revenge. Let's move to someone who comes straight out of the Anglican tradition. This is a softer hue, but he deserves it. This is one of my favourite, most outrageous poems. It's George Herbert. It's called Prayer. George Herbert lived from 1593 to 1633, contemporary of John Donne. This is one of the most extraordinary sonnets in the English language, in my view, because it is essentially a list, and each item in the list is one half of a seesaw. And yet, logically, even though the two parts weigh each other, they don't work together quite in the way one would expect. It's not an argument. And poetry is really an argument. Prayer, the church's banquet, angels' age, God's breath in man returning to his birth, the soul, in paraphrase, heart in pilgrimage, the Christian plummet sounding heaven and earth, engine against the Almighty, sinner's tower, reversed thunder, Christ's side-piercing spear, the 6 days' world transposing in an hour, a kind of tune which all things hear and fear. Softness and peace and joy and love and bliss, exalted mana, gladness of the best, heaven in ordinary, man well dressed, the Milky Way, the bird of paradise, church bells beyond the stars heard, the soul's blood, the land of spices, something understood. That's an extraordinary ending, something understood. Because, in fact, if you're logically trying to follow the connectives, I suggest it's impossible to understand. The understanding comes from the thrill of faith. What Herbert is exploring for this reader is the capacity that faith gives you to leap. We talk about the leap of faith. He does it here. From phrase to phrase, he takes outrageous leaps. He justifies them because he's alive to what the psalmist called the beauty of holiness. Now, I'm going to quote from Austin Sanders in The Spectator on the 7th of January 2013 because I can't think of a better way of saying this. And yet, when I read what he said, I think, that's it. Austin says, if faith is, among other things, a project for living well with others, then one of the resources that project can call upon is its aesthetic strength. Beauty exerts a power over people. Experience of beauty shapes and reshapes us, ordering our sense of what we value, and opening us to new ideas by making us hold what we thought we knew in suspense. Prayer seems to be spoken by someone who has become, at least temporarily, rapturously overcome by the beauty of their own activity of praying. Even as it reaches out into the world, even as we get this astonishing statement, heaven in ordinary, it's rapture that informs this poem. It's actually a fervent poem. It's dare I say, almost a Baptist poem. I can hear chanting again. I can hear things that are just on the edge of becoming dangerous. And for that reason, perhaps, are exciting. So, the beauty of holiness can make holiness something believed in, Austin Sanders says of this poem. And I agree with him. Let's go back to the small boy with the bike and the papers. One of the things that small boy learned as he was riding through sunshine and rain was that he was outside and everyone else was inside. He was excluded. He was on the margins. He was not important. But that gave him a kind of liberty. Being on the margins, not having any economic or political power, not having any social standing, just being the paperboy, meant that people didn't notice him, which meant he got to hear lots of conversations he wasn't meant to hear if he lingered at a mailbox, which meant he got to look through windows he shouldn't have looked through, which meant he got to hear conversations in the street that turned into arguments that then turned into makeup. In other words, the exposure that you get when you're marginal is very different to the exposure you get when you're central. You'll recall that when I took the podium, I said there was no authority. I think poetry needs to work very hard not to have authority beyond that the reader gives it. It's a very democratic art in that sense. There is no delivery from on high. There's none of the poem I just read you. Even though we're talking about man's relationship with God, even though Herbert is taking the thrill of the Holy Spirit and trying to put it into language, there's nothing from on high. It's open for sharing. And you see that in his punctuation. Basically, he works, you know, a lot with commas. You know, he understops, especially for his age, so that the rush comes. And the rush that I had as a paperboy was from all the sensory experience going into a head that was already in love with language, but was already concerned with the wider world, with the adult world. What did I see as a young boy when I looked up at the adult world? I see what my son saw and what my stepdaughter saw. I see a capacity for destruction. I see an unwillingness to listen. I see an overvaluation of material gain and an undervaluation of a contemplative life. Poetry is not a corrective necessarily to these things. It is a balance, but not a corrective. What's the distinction I'm making? The act of writing a poem and the act of reading a poem cannot change political injustice. What it can change is your relation to self and your understanding of what liberty is available to you. All the freedom that a poem gives you is internal. Beyond, of course, the lilt in your step that I talked about when you hear someone sing. That is external. When poets come to consider wider political issues, they frequently operate from an area of human despair. It was Shelley who said that poets were unacknowledged legislators of the world, but in his poetry he doesn't believe it. And in the most famous sonnet that he wrote, and one of my favourite poems, Ozymandias, the view is very much a long one and opposed to human ambition. I'd be very surprised if anyone in this room doesn't know this poem. Ozymandias. I met a traveller from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. What a wonderful dying line. What a fall. Ozymandias is the translation into Greek of part of Ramses' throne name. And the sonnet itself paraphrases the inscription on the base of the statue given by Diodorus Siculus in his Historica, as King of Kings am I, Ozymandias. If anyone would know how great I am and where I lie, let him surpass one of my works. It all goes. There's nothing very original in that message, but it's something that we need to hang on to, and we need to put at the centre of our contemplation. Everything that annoys you today will pass next week, or next month, or next year. You will pass. Everyone you care about will pass. While we have differing views, I suspect, on where one might end up, and even if there's a place to end up, or a non-place to end up, the transience is undeniable. Poetry plays with time, so of course it plays with transience. It exists in time. What is lineation but actually the bookmarking of time? A poem changes direction. It moves from one line to the next, largely so that the surface meaning, the dictionary definition of the word that hangs on the end, can be undercut or reinforced by the beginning of the next line. Think of the next line as a commentary on the previous line, so there's a continual argument, not quite as direct as an argument, say, between a violin and an orchestra and a violin concerto. Not as obvious, but nonetheless real. And you'll understand very quickly that a good poem is dynamic, that it is not a fixed set of lines with one reading, but that it will incorporate different moods that you bring to it. It is big enough, it is successful enough technically, to be open to your moods. So the poem that is a love poem and seems gentle when you feel gentle will be angry, maybe, when you're angry. This is why one can never tire of a poem once it's been made part of one's personal tradition. I think that you can get tired of clothes. I think you can get tired of songs even, because the melody predominates, and once it's a certain level of exposure, and you might suggest you want to throw it away or at least not hear it for 15 years. I never want to hear a beautiful song again. It's not because I don't think they're good, it's because I've heard them too many times. But a poem is only accessed when you're in the mood for the poem. It is not essential to your day-to-day life. It is not something that you likely read 20 or 30 of in a day, let alone in a month, a year, a lifetime for some people. It is something that is special. You present yourself to a poem, I suggest, in a way that you don't present yourself to a novel. In a novel, as I suggested early on, you're going for narrative drive. In a poem, you're going for something more complex. Either that, or you're misjudging your reading, and you will put the poem down very quickly. Now, while my daily experience is that most of us are dormant most of the time, and we often call it being busy, which I find wasteful rather than desirable, I also own the problem, it's a logical and a psychological one, of becoming. Becoming, it's a contradictory matter. It often seems to me that contradictory matter actually belong in the same sentence. Now, as a child, I intuitively subscribe to Parmenides' notion of block time. Now, its most prominent adherent is Einstein, who was taken to task by Popper for a view that reduces change to the status of an illusion. While I'm intellectually uncertain about essentialism, I write from the imaginative position that what is, is. Everything already exists and for always. I have not made a poem without that being the starting position. Everything already exists and for always. What is, block time. If everything already exists, including the poem I'm trying to write, then composing is really transcription. It's a privileged kind of listening. As the Czech poet Jan Skasil put it, poets don't invent poems. The poem is somewhere behind. It's been there for a long, long time. The poet merely discovers it. And discovery is predicated upon listening, which is the common name for inspiration, which is very close to prayer, in fact. I view poetry as a way of knowing. It's primarily an attempt to understand rather than an aesthetic endeavor, although, of course, it takes many aspects of the aesthetic to inform the listening. Now, incidentally, this means that I treat contemporary notions of hierarchy, you know, who's the best poet, what's their best poem, with suspicion. And I also note that technical models move in and out of fashion too. For instance, irony has been overvalued, in my view, in New Zealand poetry for the last 25 years. It has been a kind of default setting. It has been a protection against faith, and it's been disastrous in terms of the poet's ability to engage with major existential themes. It's impossible to engage with existential grief if you're busy maintaining irony. When I'm writing, while I expect to hear something, I also expect that whatever I hear will be unexpected. If all I hear is the voices of past poets, then I'm literally at a dead end. And this is where I want to move into the 20th century. Great as my admiration is, and great as most of my colleagues' admiration is for the poets of previous centuries and their skill with language and their ability to cast light on the human condition, while the core human condition has not changed, the technical circumstances have. At no time in history, and I'll repeat it, at no time in history can something have happened in Africa and have millions of people who are not in Africa know about it within literally 10 seconds. You can have a live broadcast from Africa and have just that experience again and again and again, so that we are accustomed almost to demand it. This is a problem for poetry. Why is it a problem? It's a problem on three levels. The very obvious pragmatic one is that there are so many distractions from a contemplative still centre, the still centre I predicated this talk upon, that it's difficult for people to access the centre inside themselves, whether it's to pray to deity or to present themselves to a work of art. Secondly, people often feel inadequate because the core education of the 20th and 21st centuries, at least in New Zealand, doesn't take on board, as it did a couple of centuries ago, but for a much smaller group of people, a privileged group of people, knowledge of religious texts, knowledge of Shakespeare and Milton in any substantive way, an understanding of what Dante might have been going on about when he was writing the Inferno. I could go on. It's actually not an elitist game I'm playing. I'm talking about the restriction of reference here. When you're writing now, you essentially are working with a diminished palette, to change the analogy. You've only got a few colours compared to a few centuries ago. And part of the problem is there are already so many colours out there being used in different ways. The poet I want to use to hinge into the 20th century and modernist concerns, in fact, is very backward-looking. It's Constantine Kefauver, the Egyptian Greek. He lived from 1863 to 1933. He was first introduced to the English-speaking world by Ian Forster. They were both gay, but that's largely irrelevant in the poetry I'm going to read to you. I talked about all times being simultaneous. Well, here's an example. To have taken the trouble. I'm broke and practically homeless. This fatal city has devoured all my money. This fatal city with its extravagant life. But I'm young and in excellent health. Prodigious master of things Greek. I know Aristotle and Plato through and through. Poets, orators, or anyone else you could mention. I have some idea about military matters and friends among senior mercenaries. I also have a foot in the administrative world. I spent 6 months in Alexandria last year. I know, and this is useful, something about what goes on there. The scheming, the dirty deals, the rest of it. So I consider myself completely qualified to serve this country, my beloved fatherland, Syria. Whatever job they give me, I'll try to be useful to the country. That's my intention. But if they frustrate me with their manoeuvres, we know them, these smart operators, no need to say more here. If they frustrate me, it's not my fault. I'll approach Zabinus first, and if that idiot doesn't appreciate me, I'll go to his rival, Gripus. And if that imbecile doesn't take me on, I'll go straight to Hyrcanus. One of the three will want me anyway. And my conscience is quiet about my not caring which one I choose. The three of them are equally bad, Syria. But a ruined man, it's not my fault. I'm only trying, poor devil, to make ends meet. The almighty gods ought to have taken the trouble to create a fourth, an honest man. I would gladly have gone along with him. That is such a magnificently observed spearing of special pleading. Special pleading being one of those less admirable things that we're all prone to, particularly when we feel put upon and we're aware that perhaps decisions have not gone well. It is how, of course, pragmatists justify appalling decisions that have negative consequences on hundreds and sometimes hundreds of thousands of people. They had to do something. What else could they do? It was the greatest good of the greatest number. Yes. Poetry is never concerned with the greatest good of the greatest number. If poetry is elitist at all, and I've already mentioned that I don't think it is, it's because it always speaks to the individual. You recall I said that it's complete nonsense, as far as I'm concerned, to say, I write for the people. You never write for the people. You write for one person. An internal auditor, the self, yes, but it's not entirely narcissism, because language, because it's the history of being human, will take you beyond concerns of the self. If you use language carefully, language becomes a plank you can walk out onto the sea on. You don't become God, but you do have the feeling of walking on water, very briefly. Then if you're sensible, you scurry back to land, before you fall in and drown. Let's move. Let's move to our first American poet. Really, the dominant model for English-speaking poets in the 20th century has come from America. It's been the dominant economic power. And it's no accident, of course, that its literature has also assumed preeminence in the Western world, including from about 1969-70 in New Zealand. I'm going to read a poem by Elizabeth Bishop, who lived from 1911 to 1979. She, of course, was a contemporary of Robert Lowell and John Berryman, but she lived most of her adult life in Brazil, and she was also lesbian, so she was perhaps leading an unusual life, even by poetry standards. Regrettably, she was also an alcoholic from an early age, and indeed her partner had to lock her in a room and not let her out and not let her have alcohol until she'd written a poem. This is an unusual way of getting someone to produce a poem. One would hope that the attraction of making the poem would surmount a desire and help one rein it in, but alas, not. Nonetheless, a tremendously gifted writer. I want to say a few things about this poem before I read it. It's moderately long. I think this poem is filled with the pain, the strain, the difficulty of seeing. It is so closely observed, there are so many descriptive elements in it, that the object, a fish, starts to pulse. I'd suggest that midway through the poem, the reader's not sure whether the fish exists at all, precisely because it's so closely observed. Hang on to that and we'll unpick that once I've read the poem. The fish. I caught a tremendous fish and held him beside the boat, half out of water, with my hook fast in a corner of his mouth. He didn't fight. He hadn't fought at all. He hung, a grunting weight, battered and venerable and homely. Here and there his brown skin hung in strips like ancient wallpaper, and its pattern of darker brown was like wallpaper, shapes like full-blown roses stained and lost through age. He was speckled with barnacles, fine rosettes of lime, and infested with tiny white sea lice, and underneath two or three rags of green weed hung down. While his gills were breathing in the terrible oxygen, the frightening gills, fresh and crisp with blood that can cut so badly. I thought of the coarse white flesh, packed in like feathers, the big bones and the little bones, the dramatic reds and blacks of his shiny entrails, and the pink swim bladder, like a big peony. I looked into his eyes, which were far larger than mine, but shallower and yellowed, The irises bent and pecked with tarnished tinfoil, seen through the lenses of an old scratched isinglass. They shifted a little, but not to return my stare. It was more like the tipping of an object toward the light. I admired his sullen face, the mechanism of his jaw, and then I saw from his lower lip, if you could call it a lip, grim, wet, and weapon-like, hung five old pieces of fish line, or four in a wire leader, with a swivel still attached, with all their five big hooks grown firmly in his mouth. A green line, frayed at the end where he broke it, two heavier lines, and a fine black thread, still crimped from the strain and snap, when it broke and he got away. Like medals with their ribbons, frayed and wavering. A five-haired beard of wisdom trailing from his aching jaw. I stared and stared, and victory filled up the little rented boat. From the pool of bilge where oil had spread a rainbow around the rusted engine, to the baler, rusted orange, the sun-cracked thwarts, the oarlocks on their strings, the gunwales, until everything was rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. And I let the fish go. Pretty much a perfect ending. Not only is it accurate in terms of what fishermen do when they care about the act of fishing rather than catching, it respects the process of the poem. You'll recall that I directed your attention to the strain, the pain of looking. I'm not trying to predicate response, but every time I read this out loud, I'm taken by how the small details, rather than contribute to a physicality, even though they're visceral, work against it. How the poem's fish becomes a symbol for something much larger. And of course, it's not an accident. A fish is a Christian symbol, because Bishop, while not a practicing Christian, grew up in a Christian society and was utterly familiar with Scripture. You get something that is daily, that is not very special, that is valued for contributing to the richness of your own life, but that doesn't have to sacrifice its own. It's a kind of implicit model for how human beings might live. It builds on the hunting instinct that I suggest is inherent in humans, and we demonstrate that, alas, with one another. But it takes it into a zone of joy and expansiveness and giving. And I let the fish go. I didn't need the fish to serve my ambition. I had the joy of catching the fish. I had my minor triumph. And I had the wisdom to surmount that minor triumph in the soul. That's something a fine poem can help you do. Poems are not in the service of the ego, not even in the ego of those who make them. There are plenty of vain writers. But in fact, their best poems undercut their vanity. Their best poems are not the foundation for their vanity. Now, here's a ghostly whisper from Montaigne. And he's paraphrasing Seneca. A straight oar looks bent in water. It is not only seeing which counts, how we see counts too. Montaigne was writing at a time when the intellectual optimism of the Renaissance was being bruised by religious conflict. And we read at a time when the economic optimism of the American dream has visited nightmares upon the heavens. Optimism, whatever its occasion and its object, is not enough. The rowboat waits, and one day no one will notice how the strait becomes bent, yet remains straight. But optimism is necessary for poetry, which is a kind of analogical thinking. Why? Because, and I've said this before, it's critical to my enjoyment of poetry. Because it takes faith to leap. You cannot make a metaphor without leap. The privileged authorities, whether from the state or private sector, use words to circumscribe, to diminish, whereas poets use words to open, to expand. This is incidentally part of the charge that is sometimes laid at poets' door, and sometimes with justice, that they don't make sense, that they obscure things, that they make the simple difficult, that they use their intellects to dress up very straightforward notions, that they are, if you like, trick performers who belong in a circus, or are perhaps ice skaters, busy to convince you of how quickly they can go around the rink, but not really achieving anything. Well, Yanis Ritsos, my second Greek poet, lived from 1909 to 1990, was a Marxist and atheist. What's the light of that? in a beautiful poem called The Meaning of Simplicity, which is translated by Ian McKeeley. I hide behind simple things, so you'll find me. If you don't find me, you'll find the things. You'll touch what my hand has touched. Our handprints will merge. The August moon glitters in the kitchen like a tin-plated pot. It gets that way because of what I'm saying to you. It lights up the empty house and the house's kneeling silence. Always the silence remains kneeling. Every word is a doorway to a meeting, one often cancelled. And that's when a word is true, when it insists on the meeting. I'm going to read that last stanza again. Every word is a doorway to a meeting, one often cancelled. And that's when a word is true, when it insists on the meeting. If you find a poem that speaks to you year after year, it's because it insists that you meet yourself. And it may insist that you meet a part of yourself that you're not very keen to meet. For instance, the dark, angry poems of Sylvia Plath have become favourites with many young women. I can think of Sex in my immediate acquaintance, who hold her as their favourite poet. And it's that bitterness and anger and the pushing against pen and the outrage that a sense of entitlement has been frustrated that attracts them. In other words, there's a kind of selfishness and immaturity. But Plath's poem will hopefully help, along with numerous other things, the woman move beyond that position by articulating so powerfully such a selfish, narcissistic position. You can paradoxically in literature help someone through it. What do we see when Yanis reads this poem, which goes here? The situation is from home is the Odyssey. I'd observe that if language is an after effect of experience, i.e. right out of experience, then experience is also an after effect of language, which is why I said what I did about a Plath poem helping a woman through a self-centered situation where her sense of entitlement is outraged. Citationality, which is the direct quotation or the indirect allusion to other texts, is a technique for interrogating the self. Yet it requires empathy for others, and respect for silence, which incidentally I regard as generative, and therefore, if you had to put a gender on it, feminine. And again, to enter is to enter into relation with the greater than. When I speak, you hear more than me. So this poem is called Penelope's Despair. The situation is that Odysseus, after many years away, has returned home, claimed his wife Penelope, and vanquished the suitors. And this looks at Penelope's position. It wasn't that she didn't recognize him in the light from the hearth. It wasn't the beggar's rags, the disguise, no. The signs were clear, the scar on his knee, the pluck, the cunning in his eye. Frightened, her back against the wall, she searched for an excuse, a little time, so she wouldn't have to answer, give herself away. Was it for him, then, that she'd used up 20 years? 20 years of waiting and dreaming for this miserable, blood-soaked, white-bearded man? She collapsed voiceless into a chair, slowly studied the slaughtered suitors on the floor, as though seeing her own desires dead there. And she said, "Welcome," hearing her voice sound foreign, distant. In the corner, her loom covered the ceiling with a trellis of shadows, and all the birds she'd woven with bright red thread and green foliage, now, on this night of the return, suddenly turned ashen and black, lying low on the flat sky of her final enduring. Not only does that seem to me psychologically an acutely poignant portrayal of the attainment of desire and the frustration of desire simultaneously, because of course when you're away from the object of desire, the desire morphs. It becomes something different from the object of the desire, but you don't realize it, because of course the object's not there to bring you back to the real world. This is why fantasy is so essential to human beings and so dangerous. It's why, in fact, when you get a group of like-minded people with political power, they can convince one another of the most absurd things, like there are weapons of mass destruction, even though the United Nations are telling them they're out. It's really important that poetry be read, that literature, novels, be read. Because just by encountering an imaginary world that nonetheless is predicated on close observation, you as a reader are taken beyond your cursory assumptions about many things. It's not that writers inform, it's not that writers write from on high, it's not that they necessarily know more about very much at all than you, although they do know how to use language if they reach you. It's that they are another perspective, and then multiple perspectives, and therefore they're a tonic for you. Have your tonic, as my mother would say. I'm going to bring this right down. I deliberately used a kind of working class term there, because I want to read my favourite piece of close observation in English literature about the working class. And it's written by Douglas Dunn, Scots poet, born in 1942. It's from his first book, Terry Street, which basically was a series of poems about the working class street that he flattered in when he was a university student, called Men of Terry Street. They come in at night, leave in the early morning. I hear their footsteps, the ticking of bicycle chains, sudden blasts of motorcycles, whimpering of vans. Somehow I am either in bed or the curtains are drawn. This masculine invisibility makes gods of them, a pantheon of boots and overalls. But when you see them, home early from work or at their Sunday leisure, they are too tired and bored to look long at comfortably. It hurts to see their faces, too sad or too jovial. They quicken their step at the smell of cooking. They hold up their children and sing to them. A real enormous amount of compassion has got into very direct language and close observation. How the men of my childhood, and this is why I respond strongly to this poem, were defeated by their own tiredness, by the necessity to work overtime, by the necessity to be the breadwinner, by the necessity, socially sanctioned, to have the woman at home, in her own jail. Whether the jail of work is any better is another question I'm not going to go to, because it's not in the poem. How the man's relationship when I was a child was often mediated through tiredness rather than through enthusiasm, which was somewhere in his heart, but not easily accessed. How men weren't even available to their wives for discussions. All one suspects satisfying lovemaking, and that's a leap. Everything was in the service of work, and work was outside the home, work was outside the self. It was an exterior life that the fathers of my generation, by and large, led when I grew up, close to those 499 state houses in the eastern suburbs of Christchurch. And Douglas Dunn, writing from Hull, which is where Terry Street is, in the late 1960s, gets that tiredness perfectly, and he makes me feel compassion. And when he makes me feel compassion, I transfer that compassion to many things in my life through the day. So the poem is, if you like, a kind of calling to order in the way that some religious texts are, and yet it's the most straightforward thing. It doesn't have any pyrotechnics linguistically. It's actually really simple to write, and yet it's so well observed it's impossible to write. Now, we're at 23 minutes past. I've got 7 minutes left. I'm going to move on to the next poem, another Scotsman, W.S. Brown, from 1918 to 1986. It's called The Last Lesson. The context for this poem is a series of poems which are directed from a teacher of music to his pupil. The pupil has come for the last lesson. The pupil is called Carl. So the tutor speaks. Dear Carl, this morning is our last lesson. I have been given the opportunity to live in a certain person's house and tutor him and his daughters on the traverse flute. Carl, you will be all right. In those recent lessons, my heart lifted to your playing. I know. I see you doing well, invited in a great chamber in front of the gentry. I can see them with their dresses settling in, and bored mouths beneath moustaches, sizing you up as you are, a lout from the canal, with big ears but an angel's tread on the flute. But you will be all right. Stand in your place before them. Remember Johann. Begin with good nerve and decision. Do not intrude too much into the message you carry and put out. One last thing, Carl. Remember when you enter the joy of those quick, high archipelagos to make to keep your finger stops as light as feathers, but deafened. What can I say more? Do not be sentimental, or in your art. I will miss you. Do not expect applause. Again, that's a magnificent feeling. And again, why do I like it? Compassion. Enormous empathy leading to compassion. In other words, a force for good, a force for understanding. 2009, I was in Nicaragua at a poetry festival. Nicaragua, of course, was torn apart by a civil war. Thousands of Nicaraguans were killed. The country was impoverished. The United States, in its great beneficence, funded a disgraceful group, and I expose my strength, a disgraceful group of privileged males to essentially take over the country against the democratically elected Sandinistas. And yet the people found joy. There was no middle class that I could perceive. You were either extremely wealthy, and I enjoyed the hospitality of one of the wealthiest men in the country because he had the rights to bottle water. You can't drink water out of a tap because it'll make you sick. So he was extremely wealthy. And there were people who lived on the street and worked on the street and survived and occasionally died on the street. And instead of a middle class, they were just armed police. And yet, I come back to the capacity for joy. And this loops me back to W.S. Graham writing in Scotland, but writing as if he's in Germany at the time of Mark. The joy of those quick, high archipelagos to make to keep your finger stops as light as feathers, but different. It seems to me that in suffering, we think of heaviness, but actually in suffering there's lightness, there's a failure to ground. The body might feel heavy, but actually the soul is not as heavy as one might imagine. The soul is floating, but not really in a place of satisfaction, not really in any place at all, in a place that might be called in the Christian sense limbo. The soul is often floating. A day-to-day experience, it seems to me that very few people are grounded for most of the time, most days. Poetry is one way of leaping, but also grounding yourself. I write to know more about myself and the world that turns irrespective of self, the world where you are. For me, the most precious aspect of poetry is its capacity to capture and perhaps even to create intimacy. However, I know language can also distort the thing it names. I take heart from William Langland's poem, Piers Plowman. Counsel with me kind, quod I, what craft is best to learn? Learn to love, God kind, and leave all love. Poetry can't quite teach you to love. There's a lesson for love there. Thank you for your time.